condition of settled residence or a photograph.
Okay, thank you. That's cool. I've been asked to talk about size and body condition in respect to nutritional status. I gave a similar talk at the first workshop, so apologies to those of you who saw that. I'm going to do a brief recap of that information, but also try and address some specific comments that were made in response to the panel's draft report made specifically by the Northwest Fisheries Science Center. To do that, I'll try and do some new data analysis that clarifies a few points. We don't have any new data because we haven't had any funding to do this again, but I think we've got some new insights that are quite revealing. This is a collaborative project between the Center for Whale Research and the NOAA Fisheries Southwest Fisheries Science Center. At the Southwest Center, we have a program, the Cetacean Health and Life History Program, that specializes in photogrammetry. And it's a great match with the Center for Whale Research, which has a photo ID study in southern reds. And it's been ongoing for almost four decades. So a quick recap. We've got two photogrammetry tools that we use to provide information on individual size, growth, and condition. On the top left here, we see aerial photographs that can tell us absolute length and widths of animals and body condition. And for a longer period of time, we've collected laser photogrammetry data where we project laser dots of known separation onto the whale, and we can use that as a scale of known size to measure body proportion and size. For example, to look at individual growth. And I'll touch on aspects of both of these. I'll start off with the aerial photogrammetry, because it's quite exciting data. We did one aerial photogrammetry effort in 2008, where we used a helicopter platform to get directly over the head of whales. If we know the altitude, precise altitude, the focal length of the lens, we can calculate scale, and therefore extrapolate photographs from pixels to absolute sizes. One of the real values and joys of studying this population looking from the air is we can tell individuals apart. This just shows one slide of L78, who unfortunately may now be deceased. We're waiting for cancer to confirm that. And he shows he has a really nice asymmetrical pigmentation pattern on his saddle. That means when we get overhead of him, we can tell who he is just by his saddle patch pigmentation. We're able to identify all southern residents from the air, based not only on saddle pigmentation, but also on scars and scratches. And that's largely, well, entirely due to Ken's long-term photo ID catalog. Using this technique, we were able to measure more than three-quarters of the population in just 7 hours of flying. Here we show the maximum length estimates, the maximum with the least bias. For those whales, for males in white and females in black. And these asymptotic length at age estimates really show the precision of that technique. We also got a hint at some residuals around these average growth curves. So for example, if we look at the adult females, which we have more individuals alive and therefore more power. We can see that young females of adult age, less than 30 but more than 15, are typically have been smaller or are currently smaller than old females of adult age, more than 30, which leads us to speculate that perhaps that their early growth occurred in periods of food limitation leading to a decrease in adult size. Just speculation, but some intriguing data for monitoring in the future. We're using the laser photogrammetry approach, we're actually directly able to monitor individual growth. We've been collecting laser photogrammetry data since 2004, so we can see where the individuals fit relative to this average growth curve. So for example, this is one individual, J30. At the top, on the top right, you can see a photograph of the laser dot projected onto his fin in 2004 when he was 10 years old. Once we've measured dorsal fin size, we can use any photograph of that animal in the same encounter or even the same year to extrapolate the size of the body photographs that have the dorsal fin in it. So in this case, we can measure his body in 2004 and his fin and body again in 2008. And look at where he was relative to that average growth curve. Here, this is the previous growth curve I showed, but now just showing blowhole to dorsal fin length, because that's the only measurement we can get of body size from a boat when we're doing the laser work. But this just shows the value of individual-based monitoring to see how over a four-year period he grew relative to the average growth curve that we measured in 2008. The other thing we can do using this laser approach is to look at sexual dimorphism in a dorsal fin. This plot here is just taken from the paper that Kim and I wrote that shows the adult female's dorsal fin, right, the bottom left, K16, which is dwarfed by the height of the dorsal fin of males of various ages through their teens to an adult, J1 on the right. And we know that killer whales have sexually dimorphic dorsal fins. Well, we can actually use this feature to look at evidence of growth and growth trends in a comparative approach. And this is some new data that Holly's been looking at as part of her PhD work. And here, we're comparing southern residents with Gulf of Alaska residents. Now, as we know, southern residents have, if you like, grown at 1% a year, but have experienced periods of decline. In contrast, residents of the Gulf of Alaska, that have been monitored by Craig Mackin and this group, have grown at more than 3% per year in a very steady trajectory since 1984. And what we've been able to do here is, if you look at the height-width ratio of the dwarf adult males, we can see if there's variability in the age at which they reach maturity. So in 1990, Peter Alesia published a paper in which he identified that a height-width ratio of 1.4 and above defines males that have sprouted or are reaching physical maturity. So here what we've done is looked at the height-width ratio of various males, and I've superimposed the 1.4 standard on them. And we can see that southern residents attain these mature dorsal fins at ages of 17 to 18 years, in contrast to the rapidly growing Gulf of Alaska residents that have actually attained the same level of maturity some 5 years earlier. Again, indication that southern resident growth is constrained relative to those residents in the Gulf of Alaska. Again, the value of a photogrammetry. But both these approaches, looking at growth of dorsal fin and long-term growth in body length, are not particularly sensitive metrics to body condition. What we want to know is, are whales starving and are they starving now? At the Southwest Center, we have experience in looking at body condition from photographs. Wayne Perriman, who's the leader of our program, has conducted a number of studies looking at changes in body condition of gray whales. Now, look, this is two pictures of grey whales, a fat whale and a skinny whale. In fact, the one on the left is pregnant. We know that large whales change size and shape dramatically. So the question was, do killer whales change shape enough for us to detect differences in shape and body condition from the air? Based on the same 2008 data set we collected where we looked at length, we also had an initial attempt to look at body shape, particularly condition, that we put in a 2009 report to the Northwest Regional Office. Now, we haven't published this work yet, but it's quite simply, we don't know what body width means until we get up in the air and do it again. Some individuals may just be skinny, some may be fat. But I want to review some of the findings from that and clarify some of them in some new data analysis. And particularly in light of comments that the Northwest Fishery Science Center made in response to the draft report of the panel, here's two of them, I'll paraphrase. First of all, that our report doesn't fully support the idea that photogrammetry will necessarily allow accurate assessment of status due to high measurement error. So I'm going to contend that measurement error really isn't very high in this context. And also that measurements from aerial photography didn't detect L67, the whale that was did show signs of emaciation and actually died. We photographed her on the last day that she was seen. That one's pretty easy to contend because it was our detection from the air and the boat simultaneously that actually alerted the Northwest Center of Detection. Condition, how they both come over and collect. So that's just a misunderstanding. But I'll try and elaborate on this a bit more. In that actual report we produced in 2009, I think we actually already answered those questions. For those of you who saw my talk at the workshop one, you noticed that we identified head width as a particularly sensitive metric of body condition. That's because from studies over 30 years, we've documented this peanut head condition when animals get in poor condition. Basically, you know, killer whales, when they lose mass, they lose eventually first. They've got so much structural tissue on top. By the time they get in pretty poor shape, they start losing it dorsally. And one of the areas you can see that is behind the brain case, so they have a depression behind the cranium. So we looked at a standard position behind the head and looked at the width, 15% of body length behind the blowhole. And actually detected that appeared to be a site of some interesting variability when we measured these whales from the air. The whale with the fattest head relative to its body length was a neonate, and the skinniest whale was its mother. Again, signs that perhaps there was an energetic cost that lactation could actually measure. To us, that was exciting, because signs of symmetry might be really useful for detecting changes in condition. But I'll say it again, we really don't know how useful it is until we get up in the air and get funding to do it again. But in that report, we did state that the whale with the second smallest head width was a female 67, and furthermore, she had a head thinner than all other adult females. So just to clarify that, we really did detect she was in poor condition. And in real time, we pulled in the troops. So at that stage, we indicated there was potential to use these aerial images to detect changes in body condition. So I want to talk a bit more about precision. And so particularly address that first issue. Do our measurements provide sufficient precision to detect changes in body shape and status. Well, when we're estimating size, and we were able to evaluate size of boats and none left, we had a bias. We had a bias of about 7 centimeters when estimating about 1,000 feet down. Now, but that's when we're trying to estimate absolute size. When to do that, we have to know our altitude and our focal length. Well, most of this error comes from error in estimating altitude. But where there's a misunderstanding by the Northwest Fisheries Science Center is that when we're estimating widths and ratios of widths to lengths, we don't need to know altitude. There is an error from the altitude, because the altitude is the same when we're measuring a width or a length from the same picture. And that's what we do. We're measuring the width of the head relative to the width of the whale at the anterior insertion of the dorsal fin, or to its length in the same photograph. So our only error comes from the angle of rotation of the whale, how easy it is to see its body shape, and we control that for that through quality grading of the photograph. So that the bias or the imprecision that we might have from altitude estimates do not come into play. And I'm going to emphasize that with a reanalysis of some of that data. These are just estimates that come from measurements of head width compared to breadth or length from taken from the same photograph. Now in that report, we say that the breadth is actually quite hard to measure, because when an animal's swimming on its surface, there's waves around the side of the animal. So head width was a much more precise measurement. So we can see that when we look at head width divided by breadth, the sample of body size, we have a fair amount of variability, about a coefficient variation, in this case a standard deviation over mean, of about 7%. Not too good. But even given that, we can see there's some interesting findings. So if we look at the females here, this is females organized by age in 2008. The red dot, the skinniest head width compared to breadth, now we're just using images of the same photograph, but is L67. So I'll say it again, the skinniest female, the head width relative to breadth, when measured from the same photograph, and no altitude error, is L67. So this is the mean measurement, and the error bars are standard deviations across repeat measurements of different photographs where we've estimated both the head width and the breadth on the same day from exactly the same photograph. But here there's a lot of variability, but that's because it's difficult to define breadth because of the waves breaking over the body of the animal. So now if I look at head width as a function of length of the animal, length is much easier to measure than breadth. We see we get much more precise estimates, a CV of only 3%. That's pretty precise an estimate when we're measuring from 1,000 feet up. And here we can see now our effect sizes are much greater than our error. So let's take a look at the adult females on the left here, first of all. Again, this error is error around the average. And the red dot there is L67. Clearly, skinnier head width compared to length than any other of the whales, any other adult female or male. She, in fact, didn't have much variability at all, just because of the way she was swimming when she was in poor condition. It allowed us to measure her really precisely. She was plowing through the water in a very flat orientation. And I want to draw your attention to the males here, too. This is a really cool finding, but as males increase with age, the ratio of head width to length decreases. Basically, they reach a size where the head isn't getting bigger, but they're growing longer. And what's really fun about that relationship in regards to the comment from the Northwest Center is clearly we can detect differences between whales that are meaningful beyond the measurement curve. So that's my take-home message from that. So I would say that's pretty categorical to me, and it was before the analysis. Both the statements were derived from a misunderstanding. There is one thing I agree with, though. It says that our report overstated the precision of the data that are currently available, and what I agree with is we need more repeated longitudinal data. The data that are available need to increase. Mike this morning said we need more context for evaluating error photogrammetry data, and I would totally agree. We'd like to do this again and often. I'm going to take one more minute to say that preparation for getting more data, we've actually been trying to develop more sensitive metrics of condition than just head width. So what we've been doing recently is to try and trace the whole outline of the whale and look at where the most variable slopes are between whales, inflection points in a curve fitting slope, if you like. And this is what we see where on the y-axis we've got the fraction of the breadth as measured in the dorsal fin, as standard. And on the x-axis, we see the percentile moving down the body of the whale. And this is the percentile between the snout and that dorsal fin. So where it goes under over 100% was moving behind the dorsal fin. And what we can see here is these are just reproductive age females. And we can see that L67 in the dark line, who disappeared after this day of measuring, has some really anomalous features. You can see the peanut head, this depression behind the blowhole, at between 30 and 45% of the body length. And a really anomalously thin peduncle, but really skinny area after we see 100% after the blowhole. That's some even more interesting data. Here we were able to evaluate whether the shape changes during pregnancy. We had two whales, J14 and J17, that gave birth sometime between September and following February, March. So at the time when we measured them in September, they were approximately 12 months pregnant. So we looked at their shape relative to the other group, like the females, and it's hard to show here, but the peak of their widths came after 100%, so after the position of the dorsal fin. To put that another way, they were the only two reproductive females where their maximum width occurred after the 100%. So we could detect that pregnant females were anomalously different in body shape. Now, these are only single images as currently analyzed. There's a lot of labor involved in this analysis. But again, it emphasizes we have a lot of precision when looking at shape because we don't have measurement error as a result of altitude. We're doing very similar things to look at inflection points and variable body condition data we're getting from Antarctic killer whales. I'm also working with folks at SeaWorld to look at changes in body condition as those whales change their reproductive status and conditions through the year. But to me, it's clear we have the photogrammetry, as with the hormone work Sam presented earlier, it can be a really, really useful and sensitive tool for looking at differences in nutritional status and condition. We just need to get at them.
Actually never suggested that John's report do overstated precision. We were suggesting Pam report overstated precision.
Okay. Well, I guess my comments would refer to the panel's report.
Just wanted to make that clear. And in fact, we were actually pointing to parts of your report that talked about the caveats of your data that we thought didn't come through.
Yeah, maybe it was a typo then, because I just directly from your comment, like it says that the Durban report has relatively high measurement error, so that I'm just taking that directly from your comments.
Hi, Bo.
thanks. It shows the value of this approach, I think. I just wanted to clarify the question about the error bars that Ray had.
Yeah.
I thought I heard you say that it was multiple measurements of the same photograph. Is that correct?
No, sorry, not the same photograph. So,
the same day, multiple photographs.
Well, it could be different days within our 7 flight days. The idea is that when we're looking at shape, we don't have to worry about altitude error if we're measuring our metrics from,
right,
the, same,
just ratios.
So from the same photo. It's just ratios. So the error bars are different measures from different photographs. So it's the average measure across those repeat photographs. And I should say the reason why there was a limited set there is I only picked three animals to which we had 5 or more measures. We have measures from a lot more animals, but you know we don't know how representative they are. So we try and filter them out both by quality grade. Because the great thing about killer whales is if you look at them from above, you know if you're directly overhead because you can see how symmetrical the eye patch is. They're fantastic animals to photograph.
Anybody else? I was just wondering if you had ever gone out with Sam and somebody else, and without talking to each other, independently made observations on photogrammetry, hormones, and behavior, independently analyze your information about different whales that have been paired.
It's a great idea, and it's one that Sam and I have been talking about. In 2008, where we have these measures of animal width, Sam's crew were collecting data. Unfortunately, there were only 3 or 4 samples collected in the same month as we did this analysis, not really enough to have a look at. What we have been doing, though, is looking at levels of testosterone in whales. We have these repeat laser measurements of fins. And some of the work that Sam's student Catherine did showed, you know, some of the biggest whales we have, like L78, who I showed a picture of, that grew really quickly. J30, who grew quickly, that were above the curve, had high testosterone levels, an indication that growth was related, that growth of these secondary sexual characteristics was related to the hormone level. So, you know, there's a lot of power in it. I think what an ideal sampling design would be doing both of these things so that we could relate them within the same time. Get up just over the same whales and look at how they were from the first time we did it. For example, to see whether the female that was lactating before and was skinny now doesn't have a young dependent calf, whether she's fat, and get an idea for individual variability. So, you know, I think one repeat set would tell us an awful lot, you know, just in terms of individual variability. But, yeah, so I think that's the first step, is getting a repeat set on the same individual whales. And then what we'd love to do is this curve fitting exercise to look at variability in the shape of whales, both within and between individuals, to identify these inflection points. You know, I don't think for 1 minute that one measure of head width is the best measure. I think there's a number of different measures. And you know, one of the things that actually Francis put me in touch with the guys at SeaWorld that we're doing some work with, their whales change body condition seasonally, not just because of reproductive status for animals that are changing pregnancy status. They have an opportunity, you know, to be 1,000 feet up and be overhead, just to see where the variable points are there too. So, you know, we're developing tools all the time, and I think this, if we can get some repeat measures of these same cellular resonance, we'll know a lot very quickly.
Thanks, John.